Hi, this is Bill Ringel. Hosted My Quest for the Best, where we meet business, thought, and community leaders to discuss issues relevant to entrepreneurial growth. Joining me today is Mette Norgaard. Mette is an expert on strategic leadership and learning who works with executives to design and deliver learning solutions that advance the company's strategy. Over the years, Mette has taught thousands of leaders from a wide range of organizations, including Procter & Gamble, J&J, GE Capital, and many others. Her latest book, co-authored with Doug Conant, CEO of Campbell, is Touchpoints, Creating Powerful Leadership Connections in the Smallest of Moments. She's also the author of the international bestseller, The Ugly Duckling Goes to Work, Wisdom for the Workplace from the Classic Tales of Hans Christian Andersen. Welcome, Mette.
Thank you very much, Bill.
Mette, tell me, how did you get started in the world of business after school? What was one of your first jobs?
I took a long way to get into business. My first job was actually as a physical therapist, and I started out in the not-for-profit sector working with children with disabilities, but gradually found my way into business and found that my temperament really connected very well with entrepreneurial businesses. So most of my work is sort of in that field of businesses with 800 to 8,000 associates where there's good momentum and thinking and creativity and energy. And so I just love the potential and possibilities of these ventures. But my first job in business was as a product manager in manufacturing.
What did you learn from either of those experiences, either product manager in manufacturing, or as your earlier experiences in the nonprofit sector or as a physical therapist, that helped you realize some of your talents and skills that you still are aware of today and employ in your consulting?
Well, one thing I learned is that my temperament is more for the for-profit world. It moves a little faster than the not-for-profit world. And so I am very action-oriented, and I found more kinship in terms of energy. So that was really wonderful. But I would say the other thing I learned, Bill, is that it's a lot easier to lead things as a project manager, you know, than it is to lead people. And when I was in the medical sector, I went through a significant period in California. I was living at that time, where Proposition 13 came in, and we had serious cutbacks in services. And guiding people through a period of austerity was a very tough lesson. I was not the most popular person in the world at that time, but the job had to be done.
And what insights did you gain about yourself in being able to handle that challenging situation?
I guess the most powerful insight really was that you have to find the strength within. And the way I did that, because I really do enjoy being with people and I like people to like me, but the only way I could find that strength was to always look for the principle. Like, what's the principle at play here? And so when I could find the principle, I could find the strength there and I could articulate it and I could begin to help other people see the principle involved. And so one of the things that we were faced with at that time was when you're serving children with disabilities, it's awfully difficult to cut services to some people or put them temporarily on hold. But when you could find the principle of how you would make the selections of who to serve the next 6 months and who to put on hold the next 6 months, we could make the same decisions and the same choices. But it was a painful process.
How is it that you work with companies today and help them develop their own leadership solutions and advance their company strategy? What is it that you use in order to connect with leaders to let them know about what you have to offer in terms of a service and an outside advisor?
I think the thing that I do the most is I'm really attending to what the issues are that they're faced with at the moment, more than bringing in a particular methodology or framework or a seventh step to success, whatever models we're dealing with. So it's a lot about what are your issues, where are you at, and then I draw in whatever ways of framing it that can be useful to them and help them move forward, which I think is where my action-oriented energy comes in. So it's a lot of listening. It's helping them see it more clearly and then helping them move forward around ways of seeing it that's useful for that particular leader in their particular context. and it's immensely rewarding work. I really love sitting with leaders dealing with their issues. And my unique skill is primarily the issues that relate to the human side of the enterprise. So one of the big issues that comes up time and time again is how to structure your core team. It's a lot about that human dynamic on the core team and where is it healthy and where is it less than healthy. And what I find is that a lot of senior level leaders, you can't talk to people within the team about it often, so you do need someone to help you look at it and talk through it to who is not a member of the team.
Can you share an example of a situation that you were brought into help accelerate or remedy or strengthen recently?
Well, I can give you an example that sort of was the most powerful, which was I worked with Finnish Broadcasting, like their version of the BBC,
mm-hmm.
and during a time of tremendous transformation. And their broadcasting services had been created so there was a deliberate split within the executive team, and that had been created for very, very good reasons. Finland, you know, during the Cold War was sitting very close to Russia and was not supposed to behave in ways that might antagonize Russia. Yet the country also had very deep wounds in terms of fights between the Reds and the Whites, and in Finland the Whites had won and not the Reds. But in the 60s there was this almost takeover of British broadcasting of those who were politically to the left. And so they deliberately set it up so that the head of Finnish Broadcasting was aligned with the governing party. The head of the second largest service, television, was a delegate from the opposition, and head of radio was from a third party. And so they had been embedded in 40 years of history where the country deliberately had set it up so these guys practically couldn't move forward together. And to come in and to help that team work through its history and into a for-profit model, you know, sort of post the Cold War, where that old schism no longer was relevant or necessary, it was a lot of legacy to move past. But that was one of the ones that I worked with that was most filled with tensions and drama and history and legacy. And we really, over a two-year process, managed to do remarkable work. And I would just say I've rarely seen such courageous leadership as I saw on that team.
What are two or three of the specific changes that someone would be able to clearly observe from the time that you started to the time that the process completed?
Well, one of the most profound things, I think, is that when an executive team is split, people at the next level can drive wedges in between them by sowing mistrust, right? So you sit at the executive team, you sort of agree on a direction, but when it begins to move to the next level and they don't like it, they're really able to use rumors and sowing seeds of mistrust to drive wedges in between the executives so that the organization can't move forward. And I would say to send clear signals that those days are over was one of the hardest one the group did and one of the ones that signaled the most. So I would see the group every quarter, and one of the activities, and each quarter when we'd had a meeting, I'd give them an activity that they had to do, all of them. And one session, I gave them the activity that between this session and the next, they would have to one-to-one meet with each member of the executive team and eat lunch in the cafeteria atrium where everyone could see them. And generally, they never ate lunch there. It was a fairly hierarchical organization where they'd had the executive lunch room on the top floor. But seeing people who were viewed as mortal enemies break bread together in the atrium and seeing partner after partner sit in the atrium sent a really powerful signal. It actually made people very nervous for a while because it was like you were turning the whole operation upside down. But that became one of the most powerful symbols. And interestingly, after our time together, the leaders also told me that this was the hardest assignment because they were not used to seeking each other out for informal conversations and for just getting to know each other in a conversation like you and I are having here, Bill.
It's fascinating how something so simple could lead to such profound changes because it focuses on building the person-to-person connection and overcoming a lot of the preconceptions, generalizations, and stereotypes that had been built up.
Yeah, yeah.
What is it that led you to write Touchpoints?
Well, Touchpoints came out of a conversation between me and my co-author, Doug Conant. Doug is former CEO of Campbell's Soup Company, and on his global leadership team, he had about 350 leaders, and every other year, he would pick 20 to 25 that he would personally work with for 2 years, people who had C-suite potential. And I was his partner in this process, where I would do all the design work, and I would co-lead every session, and he and I would basically teach the sessions and then have a number of externals come in as well. So at one session, he and I were walking down by a lake while the group was doing some work, and really just talking about, you know, the return to the office and the 17 interruptions every minute and the activity and the decisions. And I said to him at that moment, you know, don't you just ever, you know, get really tired of this pace and all these interruptions? And he said something that really grabbed both of us sort of spontaneously. He stopped and looked at me and he said, well, you know, to me, they're not interruptions. He said, they're an opportunity to touch someone and improve the situation. And it was almost like in that moment, he had given words to something that was part of the reason that he and I had connected so well. It was about this human connection. And he looked at me like, wow, did I just say that? And I looked at him like, I think this is profound, you know, what just happened here. And so as we walked back, we really started to talk about, would there be a whole different way of looking at all the stimulation and activity and interaction that were going on in our world? And if so, what would it take to approach every interaction as an opportunity? And over a number of years, that became the book Touchpoint. But Doug and I were in conversation around it for a long time. We were in conversation around it as we went through the financial crisis. We were in conversation around it as he went through a very serious car accident that he was recovering from. So there were many times where the book almost didn't happen, but we were just so committed to thinking about how can we help people lead whole lives in a world that now is so fragmented and overly stimulated. And so the conversation continued, and that was the basis for the book.
How long did it take the two of you to collaborate on the book?
Well, I would say the book, I had been working on a book for well over a year that was then the book I invited Doug in to co-author with me, but then after the decision to co-author was made, it was 4 years. It was 4 years. And we kind of split the work involved because I took responsibility for the writing and he took responsibility for bringing the book to market, because I would say almost both phases are equal in size. It's a lot of work to bring a book to market.
Oh, it's at least as much of a project to market it as it is to write it.
It is, without a doubt, at least as much of a project. And I had learned on my first book that by the time I was done writing it, I barely had energy for marketing it. So we tapped into separate resources, but the book definitely was created out of just hundreds of conversations between us over the years, and then also co-facilitating three cohorts of leaders through a two-year process of helping them become more and more grounded in who they were as leaders and how they could then develop the leaders around them. So it was in part sort of came out of actually doing the work and then out of our interactions.
Meta, within 4 weeks after the release of the book, it became a New York Times and Wall Street Journal bestseller. Why do you think that there was so much reaction to the book and rapid adoption?
Well, it certainly suggests that Doug did his part, doesn't it? he really put a lot of energy behind it. But I actually think the reason it did so well was that it spoke and it speaks to an issue of the times. Now, I've been out there speaking about the ideas of this book for a while now, and I'll often start a session by asking people to count up how many interactions they have in a day. So when you ask them to think about, you know, how many emails do you get in a day? I don't know, how many do you get, Bill?
Well, there are those that I get and those that I read.
Right.
There are hundreds that come in, but I have separate filters, so I'm probably reading somewhere between 80 and 100.
Okay, so each of those is a touch point, right? There's a human connection. And when you respond to them, too, it grows. And then if you add to those the number of meetings you're in every day, the number of email messages, the number of phone calls you were on, the web conferencing, the people who just stop you, you know, as a leader in an organization, as you're just walking down the hallway or heading into the cafeteria to grab some food, or people knocking on your door saying, do you have a minute? When you add it all up, what I'm hearing leaders have is pretty much a minimum of 100 today. And I'm hearing numbers most often in the 300 to 500 range. So that's a lot of human interactions a day. And I think what's happening is because of all the technology, people are kind of, you know, constantly bombarded and stimulated with somebody who wants just a little piece of you, right? And then what's happening also, because there's so many more interactions, is the duration of each interaction is getting shorter and shorter. And a study out of UC Irvine suggests that for knowledge workers, they didn't do it on leaders, but for knowledge workers, the duration you have to sit and do some serious work and thinking is about 11 minutes in a normal workday. And because we are so used to the stimulation, what we'll actually do and what they found knowledge workers doing is they would interrupt themselves twice within these 11-minute spans they had, you know, Facebook, Twitter, Google, you know, messages, mail. And so people seem to operate in about 4-minute increments unless you are on a call or in a meeting. And so you have this volume of interactions. You have the duration of interactions shrinking. And then I think the other thing that leaders are really faced with is that the consequences when you handle these interactions poorly are much greater than ever before. I mean, we see it in any little video mess up or sentence a leader speaks, or an email that's sent when you're not your best, how quickly that can get circulated. And so when I mishandle these opportunities, the consequences for something negative happening are greater than ever. But also, when I really help someone get it, that also spreads, though not as fast and as furiously as when I mess up. So I think it's these three, this perfect storm of volume of interaction, the brevity of the interactions, and the consequences of these interactions that Doug and I managed to get at in the book, and which was really kind of what was sitting in us when we started our conversation.
So is every interaction a touch point?
No, I mean, we have a lot of interactions during a day, and the way Doug and I differentiate it is that, you know, there's so many conversations going on, and many conversations are just chit-chat. To make it a touch point, because we're talking leadership here, to make it a touch point, there has to be an issue. So those issues happen both at home and at work. I mean, I was just sitting at my sister's house when her 15-year-old daughter, you know, we're sitting at the table chatting and, you know, just having a conversation, and all of a sudden the 15-year-old says, you know, Hunger Games is coming out this Friday, and I'm planning to go with my friends. And they go, fine, great, no problem. A little unusual for you to watch something like that, but cool. And then she says, yeah, and the premiere here in Copenhagen is at 11 o'clock at night, so I'll be home at 1:30. There was no.
Now we have an issue.
Now we have an issue. First time the girl is attempting to be out beyond midnight, right, this 15-year-old girl. And so immediately it shifts, and now you have a choice. As someone in that situation, are you going to approach it from your visceral reaction, or are you going to use it as a leadership moment and touch points, a leadership moment where you think about how do I tackle this issue now in a way that makes it easier to tackle similar issues next time, right? How do I do it now in a way that makes it faster or better or a higher quality decision next time? And that's really the sort of what makes it a touch point instead of just whatever could have happened in that situation. Because most of us in situations like that just quickly goes to what I want to have happen now, you know.
Right. So thinking about it a little strategically and saying, how can I handle this and learn from it or develop a system or build the relationship, something that will give it more value.
Yes, something that will even help her understand the parameters we're putting in place for making these decisions, right? Because over time, otherwise, it may seem arbitrary the way we make decisions. And I find inside our organizations, that's often the case. We don't make it visible how we are processing this issue or this decision. But, yeah, what makes it a touch point is I'm thinking now and next time, and that in that moment, I mean, anyone can really step in, like if you have a similar situation at work where something you know, something has happened, somebody is knocking on the door and saying, you know, our customer at Walmart is upset with the service that he's been gotten since we moved Jill over as the account manager, and we got to do something, right? Now, the way I deal with this issue will have consequences both for our relationship to the customer and to Jill and to me and Jill's leader. And as I'm processing this, I need to go into that situation with a leadership hat on. And what happens sometimes is actually the person in the room that does that is not necessarily the one with the most power or the biggest title, but it's the one who can sort of behave like a leader, which means they can be tough on the issue because there's a real issue here, but they can also be tender with the people involved or respectful. If tender is too soft a word, they can be respectful of the people involved and be aware of them preserving their dignity and their sense of connection or pride or whatever they have for the work they do.
This seems to draw on what you talked about in the book about every leader needs to have a code. Can you explain what you mean by that and how it fits into this context?
Yes, you need a set of personal guidelines that gives you the sense of how you process these decisions. And the clearer you are about the code, the more easily you can communicate to others the basis on which you make these decisions. Most of us have sort of a general code, you know, in terms of, you know, integrity and honesty and truth-telling or whatever it is. But when people watch you in action, are they really seeing you operate that way? So we spend a lot of time, like also when Doug and I were working with his leaders, to really help them articulate the three or four values that are absolutely non-negotiable to them. I mean, these are values that I would be able to stake my career on if they're violated, right? So we're generally not called on to sacrifice our life, but we may be called on to sacrifice our livelihood for something that we believe in very strongly. And so getting really, really clear on those will allow you to stand in the middle of all the busyness with a real strong sense of who you are and what you need to do to move the situation forward. It's what at the end of the day becomes your mirror test, right? Can you look at yourself in the mirror and say, I did all right? And, you know, again, I mean, you know, you'll mess up, and we mess up every day. We are flawed as human beings, but the only thing we ask people to do is do a little better tomorrow than you did today, right? And the code can really help guide us in doing that.
What do you see as some of the issues that people today in a very sped-up, accelerated communication cycle, especially in large corporations and businesses, that they're missing with all of the information that flows by? What are they missing about connecting and making better decisions as leaders or developing their leadership skills within an organization?
I think one of the things we really need to think very seriously about is the difference between making good decisions and making good judgments. And in the end, I mean, what you're hiring a leader for is his or her ability to make good judgment calls, right? And there are a few, maybe two or three big decisions you might need to make in a year, and you give those a lot of attention and deliberation. But there's a lot of judgment calls throughout the day also, and often we just handle them from the head. instead of maybe pausing once in a while and you could almost say mentally putting our hand over our heart and say, you know, from a logical standpoint, I know it's the right decision, but from a human standpoint, is it the right decision? How does my heart feel about this? And so I think it always comes back to that sense of I need to be tough-minded on the issue. I need to really look reality in the eyes. But I always need to remember that I get the work done through and with other people. That's why I'm a leader. That's how I get my work done. And I need to honor that relationship and look at what I bring into that relationship. And I think that's where a lot of the judgments come in, that I need to have those two work in harmony. And often
and
what
so
people feel is they don't have time to slow down and think about that, right? But it really doesn't. It's not like we're not talking about 30 minutes sometimes. We're just talking about, can I just get out of my head for a second and think of what is it that's happening to the human side of my operation?
That is very helpful. It's a very concrete step that anyone listening to this can take in order to make better decisions throughout their workday and take the time because it's a choice.
Yes.
And if you could institute a new practice for people who are leaders in their businesses, what would be one or two habits that you would offer people to adopt that would make them better leaders from where they are now?
Framing that question, what I'd like them to do is, in addition to thinking about how do I execute my strategy or my project or the thing we're working on, where execution really is about aligning a lot of the external factors in terms of metrics and rewards and recognition and all these things that I sort of look to set up systems to do. What I'd like them to do in addition is not just think about how do I execute the strategy, but how do I bring it to life? And the way you bring it to life is in every single interaction, be it on an email with just an extra two words or how fast you respond or the tone you set or a phone call or meeting people in person. And so the key comes in, how do I create these little mini interactions throughout my day where I have an opportunity to create a little more clarity or a little more commitment or a little more confidence? And the way you do that is, I would say, fundamentally, you learn to listen not just for the words but also the energy that's going on in an interaction. I like leaders to begin to look at people when they start a meeting or when you're on the phone with them or wherever you are and just assess the energy. Is it red? Are they frustrated, angry, withdrawn, depressed, whatever? Is it yellow in between or is it green, you know, excited, gung-ho, clear, thrilled? Where is the energy? And as a leader, you know, if people come into you red and they leave the interaction green, you've done a great job as a leader. You've added value. You've helped them get clearer, but you've helped them feel maybe more confident or committed as well. But if they come into you green and they leave yellow, you know, once in a while that is your job to kind of, you know, pull the reins. But I would say a good half of the time you've messed up and you should have penalty points. And we just get so obsessed about the content of what we're doing that we keep aiming for getting that solution just right instead of looking at how do I get the solution right, but have it be carried by the energy and confidence that's needed to make it happen.
And Meta, what do you read on a regular basis or listen to, either online or print or through the media, that keeps you inspired and motivated and helps you learn more?
I would say my readings are in two categories. One is the reading that helps me and leaders I work with go deeper, and one that helps us move forward faster and create changes. So I could just tell you, I just picked up C.S. Lewis's Screwtape Letters this weekend. And that would be a book that helps me kind of see what we are up against, you know, when we work with the human light and shadow. And so that would fit in the category of going deeper. Daniel Kahneman's book, Thinking Fast and Slow, really helped me think very deeply about the decision-making processes we have and how many pitfalls there are. So those would be those kind of books. Moving up and being more action-oriented, I last year read the book Willpower. It was a wonderful book about how we create very strong habits and move forward. Talent is Overrated by Jeff Coleman is one I love. So I tend to read in both categories, one for deepening and one for moving forward faster.
How much time do you spend reading that's not project-related on a weekly basis?
Well, I would say the last several months, not enough. So I just this weekend recommitted. I will be aiming for probably an hour a day or so of reading and reflection. And then that doesn't mean the newspaper, because all that does is remind me of the dark side of what we're capable of, but more things that really connects me to what we're capable of in the human connected sense.
In addition to reading an hour a day, what else do you do on a daily basis to help you stay productive and on track?
One of the things I have is I have a slide set about who I want, my own journey, my journey with others, and my business. And it's a slide deck that I constantly work on. But I think it has about 80 slides in it. So it starts with me, my energy, my health, and what I bring to the world. It spreads out to the people I'm in community with, you know, my loved ones, family, dear friends. and my journey with them, and then it moves out to my professional work and my images for that. It reminds me of my code. It reminds me of how I see change happening. And I can, if I put it on automatic play, I can move through it in about 10, 12 minutes, and it just anchors me. But often I end up sitting fiddling with statements and want it to be clear, and it takes me half an hour. But that has just been immensely useful because I'm a teacher also and a presenter, of course, and so slides is sort of my tool of how to make things visually come alive for myself.
Well, Mehdi, you've been incredibly generous with me today on my quest for the best. You shared some great ideas from your book, Touchpoints, being able to make differentiations between judgments and decisions, helping people understand that there are consequences to how information is delivered, not just the content of the information, and realizing that there are issues involved, not just sharing information, but when issues become apparent, that those are opportunities to touch someone and improve the situation, which is one of your inspirations for writing the book in itself. You shared great ideas about culture, talking about thinking about the words that we share and the energy that we listen for in our interactions within organizations. I just want to say thank you so much for sharing all these things with us on my quest for the best today.
Thank you, Bill.